This is Arts and Letters. Let's return to our conversation with Ben Johnson as he talks about poet and Pulitzer Prize winner John Gould Fletcher.
America. But over there beyond the seas, where for years the war flags have been stracked and furled, comes the crack of pistol followed by faint cheers. And now a smeary gloom appears that seems to swell from out the earth. It emerges in greenish folds above the horizon, and in its depths are flashes from far-off guns. Suddenly, from the heart of the cloud, which the cowed world watches holding its breath, come thick, insensate hammer blows that split the core of the earth asunder. The iron cannon unleashed for the dance of death.
So he was active, and this is around World War I, in two significant modernist movements. What were they?
Yes. During World War I, the Anglo-American Revolution, literature marked by imagism, marked by free verse, marked by trying to basically strip away all of the excess that had characterized the Victorian period. This was certainly Fletcher's early foray into literature and made him a name. And then later in the 1930s, Southern Literary Renaissance. Now, Fletcher's association with these seemingly contrasting movements, one devoted to experimentation and the other to the revival of tradition, in the eyes of some critics, showed either his range or, if you will, his waywardness and inconsistency. Fletcher, for himself, largely thought that he was consistent and that both movements were highly suspicious of the social and economic order of the day. And Fletcher believed that literature was not only important in and of itself, but it was important in shaping society.
All great art is a warning to the present and a prophecy for the future.
And he had a grand faith in the power of individual imagination to change the world.
This goes back to Fletcher's romantic ideas that the poet is prophet, that the poet has unique insights, and that, if paid attention to, could lead to transformations.
Those who have never known this sort of trouble can have little conception of how it feels. After a night of restless tossing to and fro, of confused dreams that do not provide normal sleep, one weakens feeling stale, with little hope or expectation of accomplishing anything during the day. The sun, as it gets higher and brighter, seems to be more and more pitiless, burning its way through the skull and the brain in an endless and changeless exasperation which transforms time itself into a meaningless eternity.
You write,
"Art may have emerged from its suffering, but the internal turmoil left him too weak to accomplish more than sporadic achievements throughout his long career."
I hardly think one can talk about John Gould Fletcher without pointing to both his melancholia and his isolation. Would you talk a little bit about his depression?
Fletcher's first major depression probably occurred in 1906, the year of his father's death, as well as when Lois Howard and Lyman Rogers eloped. In 1910, Fletcher's mother died, and he railed at his sisters until they provided him in 1911 the annuity which provided independence.
The choice of letting you go is one that I despise.
In 1916, he sailed from Amy Lowell in America back to London and married to his first wife, Daisy Arbuthnot. In 1921, he desperately craved to join Edward O'Brien's Holy Society in Florence, Italy.
Walking through the hallways of my heart.
And in 1926, he attempted to recover this disciple and was hospitalized for several weeks in a nursing home.
Driveling idiots left behind. Bedlam.
Thinking back, it's only what kills. I guess I never known just what love is.
But what happened in 1931?
In 1931, Fletcher began to suffer the insomnia that signaled a depressive phase, and this one much more debilitating than his usual melancholy. He had seasonal melancholia, but this was a major episode in 1931.
Until you go, you
His wife commits him to a nursing home. At this time, depression was treated with diet and exercise and rest, but Fletcher was not getting better. And Fletcher did return home to the home he shared with Daisy Arbuthnot, but he was not getting better. He apparently wandered away. He was involved with Lorna Hyde, even though he was still married. Then he found an American who was living in London, Conrad Aiken, a poet, a writer, very well known at the time, once again obscure today.
Right, and Aiken writes that in one horrified glance that the haggard and unkempt man before him was desperate and almost totally without will or desire. I mean, this was a profound, right, depressive moment.
Aiken took Fletcher to the amusement park, took him on a roller coaster ride, and Aiken recalled, quote, "The change in him was electric. He started to smile. He grinned. He laughed. This thing delighted him. He could not have enough of it. Fletcher was flying through the bright atmosphere of his fairy kingdom, but this interlude of boyhood did not save him."
Until you stay, please stay away.
He kind of just disappeared from places. His friends take him to a hotel. He leaves the hotel. He leaves Conrad Aiken's house. He goes to a guy by the name of Leon Underwood. He's there for a little while, and he disappears.
Right. He does spend a little time with the Underwoods, but at their home, he becomes a near recluse. He would sleep throughout the day and roam their house at night. He kept the room where he was staying in an indescribable disorder. He would wash, but that was about the only thing he would do. And Fletcher recalls feeling his teeth breaking off in his head, and he realized that the Underwoods were regarding him with almost fright, and Fletcher thought he was taking on the qualities of a vampire.
I made a mistake years ago for my sins that I had been atoned. Now you're back and I know that it's against all odds. The only answer.
So he's again admitted to a nursing home, and he escapes, and then leaps in 1931, July 10, from an upstairs window, plunges 30 feet to the ground, and he lays there with a broken shoulder.
Yes, this is, if you will, the sort of climax of this depressive episode, again, where he'd been wandering from home to home, wandering among friends' homes. And it was after this suicide attempt that his wife, Daisy, would commit her husband to Royal Bethlehem Hospital in London, often better known in the popular press as Bedlam.
I am in a madhouse, a patient in room number 4, with maniacs and padded cells nearby, and nothing in prospect but a living grave.
Well, let's talk about his relationship with his first wife. You spend a lot of time in the book chronicling those events, and it's kind of hard to figure out what their relationship actually was.
The relationship with Daisy Arbuthnot's first wife was somewhat reminiscent of his relationship with Amy Lowell, although clearly with Daisy, this relationship did become romantic. She was married to another man at the time that they began their affair. Fletcher, as with friends and lovers throughout his life, went back and forth, asked whether or not he was going to continue this relationship with her even after she got a divorce. But she was a very strong figure, apparently, very strong-willed, and it was her intensity and her decision that basically drew Fletcher in.
Another day in paradise, another day beautiful outside, oh yeah, oh yeah.
And perhaps this was a way for Fletcher to finally break from what he began to see as the overwhelming influence both of Amy Lowell and the other Imagist poets. This was a way to separate himself from this school.
Another day, another dime. Work like an ox, eat like mice, oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Fletcher moved into Daisy's home, which he shared with her and her two children from her first marriage.
So I'll stand up on my head, I'll fill my belly up with lead. I'll eat a million stars and howl at the moon.
It was a marriage that in Fletcher's telling was not particularly close or romantic from the start, but nevertheless, we have evidence that for her, Fletcher was a great love of her life.
Another day in paradise.
So in 1934, Daisy proposes that they meet in New York, and she's proposed to sail to New York because, above all, she wants to see him again. What's their relationship at this time? This is after he gets out of Bedlam.
After he's released from Bedlam, he almost immediately goes to America and returns to Little Rock. For Fletcher, this was a break not only with England, this was not only a break with his life in London, it was a break with his marriage.
As much as his mental state is failing, he's kind of all alone. He's back in Arkansas, and he's a mess. He learns that in 1938, he has won the Pulitzer Prize for his selected poems, beating out William Carlos Williams' complete and collected poems. You write that his finest poetry volume was his last, The Burning Mountain.
Fletcher, in his last phase, seemed to finally get beyond the artifices of poetry. He finally began, as a mature poet, to understand both his capabilities, but also to find a subject that was appropriate. And often this was a subject that was there at his doorstep.
The Unfamiliar House. To an unfamiliar house, once more these feet have wandered, that set forth on the road so many years gone by. And once again, a stranger, I have pondered on the serene blue depths of an unfamiliar sky. Here, where a dead youth passed, unspent yet shattered, I walk my roads neglected once again. And whether that strange past or the near past much mattered, I do not know. Here I am, loosed from pain.
So at this moment, he kind of feels like he's finally really made it.
Yes, it's in these poems that he goes back on what has been his aesthetic tradition. Instead of attempting to transform life into art, instead of relying on his imagination to make a new world, he stood aside while the destructive mountain rainstorms and the chatter of the old and young at a country reunion, or the building of a new home, measured out the hope and the sorrow flowing through the human existence.
Between me and the boy that held forlornly to his vision now stands a lofty, shining, unsurmountable wall. I stare at it in vain. Neither sympathy nor derision alters its mass at all.
Why didn't this propel him into a more of a national spotlight?
John Gould Fletcher had always been a very difficult figure, and he was regarded as such by other writers and poets and even the publishers. His books had not sold that well, and the Pulitzer Prize had been given to Fletcher on the publication of his selected poems, which was the overview of his career. But many of the poems in that book were weighted toward his early Imagist period, the World War I era. He was no longer writing that poetry, and frankly, that type of poetry was no longer of great interest.
The oak trees stand as they have stood, unchanging. The dumb stretch of the dusky, sun-browed earth still breathes in brooding unison with all my hopes, far-ranging, as on that ever-vanished day when life first brought me birth.
So tell us a little bit about his life between about 1940 and 1950 and his relationship with his wife, Charlie May.
Well, John Gould Fletcher, quickly following his divorce from Daisy Arbuthnot, married Charlie Mae Simon. She also had just divorced from Howard Simon. Charlie Mae Simon was a gifted writer, both novelist. Many of her works had been geared toward what we now call the young readers market or the youth market. But Charlie Mae Simon reveled in the landscape and history and culture of the rural South, including Arkansas. And there's no doubt that she helped to guide John Gould Fletcher, or at least make him pay attention to the possibilities of his home state and his native environment. But they were two writers who, in the home that they built on the edge of Little Rock, a home they called Johnswood, in this home they had separate studies and they went to work every day on their respective projects. And Fletcher certainly benefited from what proved to be the mostly supportive relationship of his life.
And people come. They may have kept their places in which they stood a dozen years ago, but when I grasp their hands and stare into their faces, they seem more strange than once of old.
On the 10th of May, 1950, Fletcher and his wife, Charlie Mae Simon, drove to a nearby farm to purchase eggs, and Fletcher commented nonchalantly about the progress of the work on the pond that was being dredged near their home.
I know that time and years sift wrinkles. Now I wonder what lasts between us, changing day on day. Once and for all, my fate was this, to live through torn asunder from all I might have shared. There was no other way.
In May of 1950, on the evening after they had gone to the farm and he had seen the pond, that evening, Fletcher said to his wife before he went to sleep, "I think the doctor has me on an even keel at last." Looking back, Fletcher had likely made the decision to end his life.
And when I pass from a dark hearthstone going, blue in the rosy dusk, the chimney smoke will glide, but I will be borne from it on the flowing drift of a darker tide.
The next morning, Charlie Mae Simon woke to find that his bed was empty. She quickly went to look for him. She could not find him. She called family members. Authorities were, of course, summoned. And it was a neighbor who would find him in the pond, 12 feet from the bank, lying in 2.5 feet of water.
No more than smoke can I blur these still blue skies' changeless splendor. No more than a faint blue cloud of smoke within these hearts I last. The mirror fronts me, frozen, cold, untender. There are no ghosts left now. The past is but the past.
John Gould Fletcher's funeral services were conducted in the old house, his body resting in state in the large parlor, and he was buried in the Mount Holly Cemetery near his father and mother. And after all this work, how would you like to see him remembered? Is it the poetry or the history or the odd life?
John Gould Fletcher should likely be remembered for a person of great imagination, person with remarkable gifts in verse and essay writing, and even, if you will, a narrative history. But he was also a person who struggled against a terrible disease, and in the end, he likely overcame it, even though the end of his life would seem to indicate otherwise. But he has a remarkable legacy, a remarkable body of work, and that was, once again, written in the face of the gray, horrible figure that haunted him throughout his life.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Thank you to actor Rico Artimani. Thank you to musicians, singers, and songwriters, the Ted Ludwig Trio, Ethan Young, Zach, and Big Papa Benz, Grace Askew, Star Mitchell, Silas Height, Joseph Fuller, and Drew DeFrance, Mike Montgomery, Josiah Simpson, Hosty, Handmade Moments, The Rad Trads, Ryan Saunders and Keith West, Griffin Buckley, and Ted Russell Camp. Thank you to Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack for keeping music alive and well in Arkansas. Generous funding for Arts and Letters was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to biographer Ben Johnson for shepherding us through the enigmatic life of John Gould Fletcher. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick. Let's heed the words of John Gould Fletcher. My happiness is like sand. I let it run out of my hand.